Yesterday, in his inaugural address, President Bush spoke of, quote, the truths of Sinai, the Sermon on the Mount, the words of the Koran, and the varied faiths of our people, unquote. His speech followed an invocation from an Episcopal minister after a federal judge turned down a case from an atheist who sought to stop the prayer. President's faith has helped shape his views on federal funding for stem cell research and the veracity of evolution. This hour, continuing our discussion on science and religion, we're going to talk about whether they can coexist in the realm of biology, medicine, and bioethics. How can one inform the other? We're going to also try to sort out how different religious traditions view some of the key questions in bioethics, including cloning, stem cell research, and genetic engineering. And if you'd like to be part of our discussion, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. William Hurlbut is a member of the President's Council on Bioethics and a consulting professor in the program in human and biology at Stanford University in Stanford, California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Lori Zoloth is the director of bioethics for the Center for Genetic Medicine and a professor of medical ethics and humanities and of religion at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You're welcome. Ibrahim Musa is an associate research professor in the Department of Religion at Duke University and co-director of the Center for the Study of Muslim Networks. He joins us by phone from his office there. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi there. Susan Jacoby is the director of the Center for Inquiry, Metro New York, and is author of the book Freethinkers, A History of American Secularism, out this year from Owl Books. She's with us here in our studios in New York. Welcome to Science Friday. Let me just send this over maybe to William Hurlbut. Do you think that science now, especially in this age of new technologies and biology, stem cell research, whatever, has it made it harder for people to, do you think, to keep their faith in religion and God?
Well, I don't personally think so. Mm-hmm. I don't see that science in any way has to erode the central core of the enduring traditions. There are certain types of beliefs, certain ancillary beliefs that may be challenged, but I don't think those are the central core of what is put forward as the meaning of the religion.
Mm-hmm. Lori Zoloth?
I'd have the same answer, of course. Judaism has gone through many different changes in understandings of science. It's been witness to extraordinary changes in our understanding of the molecule, of the self, of the cell, of the universe. And in fact, the religion is strengthened by a more acquisitive and inquiring pursuit of what the real world looks like. It's never diminished the understanding of what it is to be a Jew or the duties that a religious Jew carries forward into the world. Mm-hmm.
Professor Musa, can you describe the difficulties science faces in the contemporary Islamic world?
Well, I think the science does not challenge the understanding of faith in the way that that it diminishes people's commitment to religion, because I think science reveals to us the complexity of the cosmos and also about human nature, but also matter in very, very complex ways. So I think, to the contrary, it does ask and require of one to have a deepened understanding of faith. Some of the challenges that occur within the Muslim world is the whole question of divided traditions. You have the inherited traditions of Islam and forms of Islamic scientific and rationalist thinking, as well as fideistic, that is, commitments to faith that precede all kinds of other forms of interpretation, in other words, rational interpretation and more complex ways of understanding, even nurture and questions of culture. And you have that on the one hand, as well as the modern traditions that challenges some of those issues, and that does mm-hmm. create moments where lines get confused and one has lots of controversy.
Yeah, but there is a long history. I mean, I don't have to tell you, a long tradition of scientific thought in Islam. The culture flourished from 700 to 1300, breaking all kinds of new ground in astronomy that's superior to the Greeks. You had mathematics we still use today, chemistry, optics. I could go on and on. Can you explain what there is about Islam in that era that encouraged such exploration that might be lacking today?
Well, I think there was a greater self-confidence about in people of who they were and what they were, and And I think while people did struggle with different kinds of knowledge traditions, I think that there was this level of openness to understand the Greeks and to understand the Indian heritage, etc. And so the numbers that we have today come from the Indians, although it goes as Arabic numerals and all kinds of scientific flourishing. Today, I think the political conditions in different parts of the Muslim world create certain levels of anxieties that, in my view, blocks that kind of flourishing of intellectual thought, and you have forms of political repression as well as, in addition to that, a very atrophied version of religion that is very loud, and that also creates further repression of critical and scientific thought.
Mm-hmm. One of the things, I think.
Go ahead, Susan. Then I go to you, Laura.
Okay, yeah. Sure.
I think that we're overlooking something here, and that perhaps the general question about whether science makes it harder to keep religious faith is the wrong question. The question is, what kind of religious faith are you talking about? You cannot, for example, believe in the scientific method or accept the theory of evolution and also believe that the universe was created in 7 days, as fundamentalist Christians do. You can certainly believe in the theory of evolution and believe that God set the universe in motion. What you cannot do is believe in the scientific method and believe in a fundamentalist, literalist form of religion, whether it's fundamentalist Judaism, fundamentalist Protestantism, fundamentalist Catholicism, or fundamentalist Islam.
Dr. Zoloff?
I think it wasn't such a bad question, actually, Ira. I think it was sort of a smart question, because, of course, on one level, the Enlightenment cut across that which we knew to be true in the world, not only in terms of modernity and in many forms, in terms of science and how we knew things, but what we ought to do politically, who we were as individuals. So social, political, cultural changes shift at once with our understandings of the world in general, the scientific epistemological way we have of understanding things, whether seeing or deep knowing or wisdom is fundamentally altered by science. Of course it is. Of course religion changes. But the question of what one believes and how one interprets the new knowledge and how it's incorporated into older traditions, that there's a constancy in that. And let's just look at the example that you just gave, Susan. You can be a Jew who believes in traditional texts and understand that the world could be created in 7 things that are translated as days, but aren't Monday, Wednesday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, right? So there's a linguistic and normative account of re-understanding what we mean by a day, and that's the move that's made in traditional texts and even in traditional communities.
That strikes me as, if you want to make that accommodation. If you desire to be able to, if you just say, I believe what I believe, and you have to come to my way of thinking, that will never happen.
Well, a close reader of the text Susan mentions would actually note a problem in the beginning, because there's changes and things called days before there's suns and moons to define them. So there's got to be some other way of understanding it. And oftentimes people have said, look, there's 2 different ways of thinking about the word, the text, the meaning of the word, the meaning of the world, and that's been done since the very beginning of textual interpretation.
Susan?
But what you're talking about is a form of religion which allows itself to be modified by secular knowledge and accommodates itself to secular knowledge. I'm sure that you are very well aware, and everybody is talking very nicely as though there doesn't have to be a conflict. And between the kind of textual interpretation you're talking about in science, there doesn't have to be a conflict, because you're talking about people who want to make accommodations, who want to make the day as a metaphor for something else. But I don't see how any of us can deny, whatever faith we have, there's a very large percentage of people in this world, in this country, in this world, who do not want to make those accommodations, who are not interested in those accommodations, and who in fact say, no, if the Bible or my interpretation of the Quran doesn't say this literally, it cannot be true. And this is why we're having so much controversy. What we're talking about is though everybody who is religious is also, their knowledge and understanding of the world has been modified by the Enlightenment. Indeed, I think we face a situation, a dangerous situation, where a lot of people refuse to allow their religion to be modified by secular knowledge at all.
Ibrahim?
Yeah, I think I think Susan used the key word, that is interpretation, and I think the interpretation just did not happen after Enlightenment. It happened all long before that already. Every wave of new knowledge changed these historical traditions that we are living with today, and some of them have already disappeared. The question here is, if you take a tradition like Islam, where there are all kinds of statements within the prophetic tradition that describe women in particular ways as deficient in intellect, et cetera, or biologically make that to be something that is a disadvantage to a woman, if people are not going to deal with those kinds of statements that are largely culturally informed, but has a kind of religious sacrality attached to that, that is not going to be interpreted in the light of scientific understandings, and especially the Enlightenment. I was reading some texts and writing about women in pre-modern Islamic cultures, etc., and I said to myself, thank God for the Enlightenment, because some things have radically changed. So, yes, if traditions are not going to make these necessary adjustments in interpretations that they have to do, they will be render themselves unsustainable. And that's what all traditions do. They undergo process of interpretation. And whether we call that secular, whether we call that the religiously informed, or how we define the knowledge, etc., these are the processes that has been going on for some time.
And that happens, though, as Ibrahim said, very, very early on in Judaism, when Maimonides encounters Aristotelian science. He makes some moves within the Jewish tradition that are substantially different than have been made earlier. And they're pre-Enlightenment moves, but they're in it to take account of the then new science of Aristotle.
We're going to have to take a short break and come back and talk lots more with our guests. Take your phone calls. Continue talking about science and religion, so don't go away. We'll be right back with my guests, William Hurlbutt, Lori Zoloth, Ibrahim Musa, and Susan Jacoby, after this short message. Stay with us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about science and religion with my guests. William Hurlbutt is member of the President's Council on Bioethics. Lori Zoloth, who's Director of Bioethics for the Center for Genetic Medicine, Professor of Medical Ethics and Humanities and of Religion at Northwestern. Ibrahim Musa is Associate Research Professor in the Department of Religion at Duke and co-director of the Center for the Study of Muslim Networks there. Susan Jacoby is the director of the Center for Inquiry in Metro New York and author of Free Thinkers, A History of American Secularism. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Dr. Hurlbutt, as a member of the President's Council on Bioethics, you must be confronted all the time with decisions about bioethics decisions about cloning, stem cell work, things like that. Do members of the committees bring their own views and sensibilities about their religious views to the table when they decide these issues?
Well, of course, there's no way to think without grounding yourself in your own deepest assumptions. But let me say that throughout this the stem cell debate, for example, there have been continuous accusations of the president and certain members of the society trying to impose their ideology on others. I always find that a rather cheap shot because I think everybody has what you would have to call, at least in the broadest sense, their beliefs are grounded in an ideology, if you take ideology to mean a set of beliefs. Mm-hmm. Now, whether to the degree that that's a private agenda, we as a council sought to do our work through the publicly accessible reason. We tried to find those principles which would be universally acceptable. We tried to thread the arguments such that faith was both taken account of and yet was not personalized in the sense of one person's view dominating the positions of others. This is partly the key question that you are asking today, and that is, how do you know anything?
Well, I guess you'd always hope that somebody, on any council would be expressing opinions that they believe in, that they would be reflective of that, of their thoughts. And I guess what critics would be saying was then, well, you would put people on that committee or on any committee who were reflective of your own kinds of thoughts and beliefs. And certainly the president would do that also.
Well, I don't think that's, in fact, what happened. I am impressed by the diversity of opinions in the council. I don't think it was appointed as a simple rubber stamp council. I think it was genuinely put forward in light of the earnestness of the concerns. When we met with the president, the first meeting of our council, he spoke, I think, very profoundly about the meaning of this advancing technology, and he recognized that these were species issues that transcended any one ethnocentric view, any one faith, and that we needed to contend with them seriously. And he asked us to articulate all the positions from the full spectrum of perspectives.
I really think that it's a cheap shot to say that it's a cheap shot that people who say that the president is trying to write his own religious views into public policy. I think that's particularly legitimate on the stem cell research issue. What the president has done, because he is of a brand of faith that believes that any tampering with the embryo is a form of abortion, and that is murder. And that's a religious position and a very legitimate religious position. It is not one, according to serious studies, that is held by the majority of Americans. But what the president did when he limited stem cell research to those naughty embryos that were already in existence in scientific laboratories is he basically placed the religious principles of fundamentalist Protestants and fundamentalist Catholics above everything else. And as a result, what we are now seeing is the balkanization of American science, which has been the wonder of the world since World War II through the creation of the National Institutes of Health. Now we have a whole bunch of states stepping in because so many of the people in those states don't agree with President Bush's scientific restrictions. And it's all a result of his having to put his particular religious views and the views of his core Christian right constituency into law.
Professor Musa, I know you have to go, so I wanted to give you some time to chime in with any last thoughts on this and or any other issues about how Islam treats these issues.
Well, I think the last conversation on the question of diversity, I think all religious traditions as well as governments face the same crisis, and that is that while people might have very legitimate views of how they understand the world, the cosmos, nature, and God, how do they make it possible that the diversity within the religious tradition or the diversity of views within the religious tradition, how those views can become part of public policy? And I think one of the things that one sees in certain religious traditions, Islam included, that the most hegemonic voices begin to suppress those other voices that might give alternative ones and say, we have the only truth. And I think some of the complaints that I've heard about the President Council reports and some of the views on some of these very contentious issues is that there was not sufficient space for the diversity of views that might be held by people on the committee or people elsewhere. So I don't want to only home in on the President's Council issue, but I think that also applies to religious traditions.
Mm-hmm. I think that Ibrahim has raised a very interesting point. And especially, when I say I feel it exquisitely as a Jew because I never speak for the Jews because there's so many, many voices. And one of the most profound things you could say is we're all going to disagree. But interestingly enough, on the issue of stem cell research and on many issues in genetic medicine, there is a shocking unanimity among the Jewish, across the Jewish community, from Reform, Reconstructionist, Orthodox, Conservative. All sorts of Jews have really come to agreement on the nature, goal, and meaning of some of this research. And in particular, the nature of justice, the nature and the of healing, the necessity for justice, the necessity for healing, the necessity to move forward on this kind of research has been clearly expressed in the Jewish community and, quite frankly, not on the council. So if you want to hear an authentic religious voice, one that I'd say, yes, I believe in God, I believe in modern orthodoxy, I express it and experience it, and yet my voice and my tradition isn't fully expressed around the council, the voice of many members of Buddhist or Hindu or Muslim religious faith is not fully expressed on that council, and in many of those traditions, and practitioners have said this over and over again in every debate, the research is not only not prohibited, it is mandated research. And that research, that voice really hasn't been clearly articulated, Bill, on the council, and you and I have discussed this many times. People come from sincere faith commitments, and they're different, and that difference has to be taken into account.
Dr. Hurlbuth, you get one reply here to reply.
Yeah, well, that's not an easy bunch of criticisms to reply to. There are quite a few Jewish members to the council. Leon Kass himself is from a Jewish background and is active in his Jewish faith. I had a long conversation with the chief rabbi of France, and he told me that his interpretation of the ancient traditions in Judaism did not support the notion that we should create human embryos for instrumental use as raw materials for research. I'm not so sure that what you're saying, Lori, is absolutely true. And the other side of this is the Council has pronounced only on cloning issues, and that involves the intentional creation of what some recognize as an embryo, in that if it is implanted, it can go to term and produce a child in at least some cases. And if you do the surveys in America, a vast number of people believe that you should not intentionally create embryos for use in a scientific project that involves their destruction. I personally believe that a decent society does not build the foundations of its biomedical science on the creation and destruction of human embryos, and I think that reflects the view of a wide diversity of faiths.
Well, if you put it that way, of course, you personally believe that you shouldn't build biomedical science on the creation and destruction of human embryos. What you were doing is you were talking in the most stark terms about this. But, for example, and many people, and I suspect many members of Congress, don't understand the difference between the idea of cloning a human being a la Brave New World and cloning embryos for therapeutic purposes, which we're still rather far away from. But I'd like to toss out another idea to all of these people who are very concerned about the representation of every religious tradition. There are ethical questions which are very important to people of every religion or of no religion. And I think that one of the things we don't only need to, and we can never come to a total consensus within or between faiths, but we also need to have people who represent the secular point of view, which, again, is not necessarily antithetical to certain kinds of religious views. But there are ethical questions that don't depend on your being a member of a religion.
I think that's really true, Susan, and I think that what has happened is because there has been a marginalization in a historical period in American history of religious voices, now there's a reassumption, a powerful reassumption, of the need to hear the religious voices. That ought not mean that we don't hear voices of secular analytic philosophy, voices of people who are devoted atheists or agnostic, but have come to believe in a moral life. Immanuel Kant asks three interesting questions that are the central questions of bioethics. What can I know? What ought I to do? And for what can I hope? And these ideas about knowing and acting and yearning are important dilemmas for all sorts of traditions and for people who choose to follow a philosophic tradition that isn't has nothing to do with God or gods.
Well, I want to take a break just to say goodbye and thank you to Ibrahim Musa. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you, Aaron.
for taking time to talk with us.
Thank you.
Ibrahim Musa, Associate Research Professor in the Department of Religion at Duke and Co-Director of the Center for the Study of Muslim Networks. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let's see if we can go to the phones. Let's go to Hawaii. Yeah, Douglas in Hawaii. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hello. Thanks for having this program. It's so important. Thanks for having 2 hours of it as well. It's none of my business what other people believe religiously, supernaturally, except to the degree that it affects me and the world that my kids inherit. In a democracy, of course, how people believe religiously and how they want to determine politics does affect me. And therefore, the question which is most important to me is it true? Is a certain religious belief true? That's what science doesn't attempt to answer. But the byproducts of science is that we don't believe in supernaturalism. I work with environmental groups here in Hawaii on biological resource, living things, preservational issues. I think these are issues of ethics and morality. And I would submit that any religious doctrine and belief that posits a planner and a plan and the unfolding of that plan is unlikely, and I'd say unable, to support science policy that looks long and cumulatively, rationally, logically, and caringly, and certainly with the urgency that is needed in terms of so-called biological resource issues. I fear for the world that my kids inherit because of people's religious beliefs and how they view the future. Christian fundamentalists see the deterioration of our world's societies and in the environment as indicators of their belief that we're in the last days before the return of their messianic hopeful. And in fact, many ways they welcome these deteriorations. I witness it all the time in the work that I do. And the Bush administration is filled with religious zealots who are not just indifferent, but they're hostile to environmental issues and looking long in policy. I believe that most religious believers know what Pascal's wager is, but they never look at the other side of the coin. If they're wrong about their religious beliefs, then, of course, they won't be the ones to pay the price. It will be the people that follow us for the fact that today people couldn't look any further than their own desires. Now, I consider it self-deception myself. But religionists seldom ask themselves if their beliefs are in fact true. And I would ask your audience to listen and ask themselves the questions, if they're religious believers, can any religion whose beliefs are mythic and untrue guide us to a better future and our children leave them a better world? I'd say no. I'd say emphatically no. And I would recommend that everyone read your Miss Jacoby's book.
All right.
Thank you very much.
You got that off your chest. Let me remind everybody, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Susan, did you want to comment?
Yes, I do. My book doesn't really support what the caller says, although I agree with a lot of it. I think this is a great example of the kind of polarization that fundamentalist religion has created in our society. Religion itself, in general, just to say that religion prevents honest scientific discussion is wrong. A certain kind of religion prevents it.
Well, that's a good. Then why are we hearing it now? Why has it gotten to, you know, it's been around, you know, for a long time. I give a date, the Scopes trial, you know, in terms of evolution and whatever. Why is it being heard now more than ever?
Because of the enormous rise of Christian fundamentalism. I'm speaking now only about the United States.
Why is that happening?
And Why is there a rise of fundamentalism in the United States?
I think it's because the future can be quite terrifying. And there's two reasons. One, I think the future does look kind of scary. It looks kind of extraordinary, and it looks kind of scary. And what happens at these millennial moments, these moments when we really do understand some new thing, in this case it's genomics, I think some new understanding pushes us forward to rethinking who we are and how important and powerful we are. And there's two ways to think about it. And I think both people who are science enthusiasts and people who are science fearers tend to move us rapidly into a future wildly out of our control, even more terrifying than that which confronts us.
Then why don't we hear people more in the middle ground trying to take over the microphone?
Here we are trying to take over the microphone.
You know,
saying that in fact there are different religions. There's Judaism, there's Islam, there's Buddhism, there's Hinduism, all of which have different expressions. There are subtle gradations between traditions, as Dr. Musa was pointing out. There's fundamental understandings, there's futuristic understandings, there's many interpretive possibilities within it. It's too broad a brush to condemn the religious voice or pose this as questions of religion versus science. Many of these questions are which kind of religion experiences it as progressive or which kind of religion experiences it as regressive. The genetics debates are classic examples of that.
Well, one of the things that we also need to think about, though, is why there has been a rise in the developed world. The only country where there's been a rise of fundamentalism is the United States, as often our conservative public officials speak sneeringly and rightly of secular Europe. Why is the United States alone among developed countries have such a large fundamentalist movement? And I would say that some of those things are peculiar to our own history, are originate not with the rise of the religious right after 1980, but in the equation of science somehow, evolution with Bolshevism, which is a very old thing in American culture and is, of course, nonsense. In fact, the Bolsheviks turned out under Stalin to have their own anti-science ideas under Lysenko. But we can't just say that this is because we fear the future.
All right, we'll come back. We have time for more discussion. We have to pay a few bills, so stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about science and religion with my guests. William Hurlbut, who is a consulting professor in the program in human biology at Stanford University, Lori Zoloth, who is a professor of medical ethics and humanities and of religion at Northwestern University, and Susan Jacoby, who is author of the book Free Thinkers, A History of American Secularism. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. I want to move on a little bit because we've only scratched the surface of issues here, and I think a big issue that is going to be confronting us in the next few years, and maybe I could ask you about this, Dr. Hurlbut, is about the religious and ethical implications in neuroscience of understanding the nature of ourself, notions of free will, moral, legal responsibilities concerning that. How is religion, do you think, going to handle that?
Well, I don't know that science is going to have an easy time handling that either. You know, it's a very interesting thing. Science has used the reductive and analytic mode of analysis, trying to put things into measurable terms. And yet, we all know that you cannot describe the human being, human existence, simply in those terms. Science ends up just becoming a bag of bones without flesh, seen from those ways of knowing. Science and religion are two ways of approaching a single unified truth, that deep truth of the universe. Einstein said the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it's comprehensible. He obviously, or I think he meant, that it's mathematically understandable. But the mystery of it all is that somehow it seems to be constructed in such a way that it's also morally or meaningfully comprehensible. I think we know that first and foremost when we start to look at neuroscience, where we return now to the mystery of the mind. Somehow or other, chemicals became consciousness. Our normal understanding of chemistry doesn't allow for that category, even when it's constructed in a complex way. So obviously, science has a huge challenge ahead of itself, one that maybe religion can help inform.
I want to go back to when you talked about science being a bag of bones, and when we deconstruct some of these, as science likes to do, to be deconstructionist. But I would say that when scientists come across this bag of bones and they're able to strip away the muscle, the tissue, and whatever, metaphorically speaking, and find that bag, that's a spiritual moment for a lot of scientists. That's equivalent to a religious experience, having to finding the truth by digging deeper and deeper and deeper, as much as, you know, as any kind of thank you to God might be for them.
And that's a beautiful thing to say. And I was having a conversation a few months ago with Scott Gilbert, who's a developmental biologist, and he said something really nice to me. He said that developmental biology is one of the last regions of science where you're just immediately struck with a sense of awe as you investigate it, this amazing mystery of how the human person unfolds from these primordial combinations of cells. And I must say, in studying the stem cell issue, I've sensed that sense of reverence looking at developing life, just the same sense I get looking at pictures of the Hubble telescope. The point is, Scott Gilbert went on to say that this sense of awe differentiates along two lineages. One is the curiosity that leads to science, and the second is the reverence that leads to religion. And I think to really understand the world, we need both of those human ways of seeing and feeling.
I'm not sure that it's so divided, Bill. I think that one of the things that's interesting is that Greeks thought about knowing as making, and Americans think about science and knowing as unmaking things into smaller and smaller pieces. But most thoughtful scientists that I've ever known and spoken to have exactly what you say, this reverence, this sense of seeking for the whole, seeking for how the thing works, and that's true for people who are at JPL looking at the extraordinary photographs of Mars, people who are looking at the smallest little molecular reactions, doing proteomics. I again and again I hear this sense of the exquisite beauty of the natural world. The search for the real, the search for the actual, I think can be held in common between people who do religious scholarship and religious faith and people who search for the actual in the physical world as well. I don't think there's such a divide inherent to the quest.
You know, when the Red Sox won the World Series last year.
Now, that's a faith-based moment. Now, if only the Cubs would do it, that would be the ultimate scientific proof of
that's
God.
Absolutely. I asked Scott Simon about that. You know, the there there, people had religious experiences. Some people said, you know, for God's finally shining down on us. But people, other people would say they finally got the right pitching staff. You know, the difference there being they had the same.
Yeah, Yankees fans.
They had the same. They had the same feeling. And, you know, they had the same feeling, but they attributed to different sources. You know, one said, I saw an act of God, and one saw an owner who had enough money, you know. And that, there was that way of doing it. Susan, you wanted to say something, Kelly.
No, actually, I was about to say something like that too, and I'm now beginning to feel reverence in the feeling that the ownership of the New York Mets is finally spending some money on decent play. No, but seriously, I think reverence is not something that only religious people feel, and perhaps reverence in a religious sense is not the word for it, but awe, and I think perhaps what scientific rationalists, I would say, are willing to admit that extreme right-wing religious people are not willing to admit is in the end we can't know. Science can describe the process of evolution, but science can't tell us how and why that first piece of matter came to be. Now, religion says it can, but I don't believe religion can either. Religion can no more answer the question of where God came from than a scientist can answer the question of where the very first piece of matter emerged out of nothingness. There are some things, to say that they're a mystery is one way of putting it. There are some things that we can't know, we can only believe.
Well, that is not a question in religion where God came from. That's an answer, that God is the source and significance of being. And Susan, I
would say that's a nonsensical answer.
By also, a certain type of thinking.
That's also...
But let me just
unique,
say this about...
Christian
Professor
Zoloff,
let Dr. Holbrook finish.
Yeah. Susan, I agree with your notion that not all formally religious people... reverence is not limited to people with formal religious faiths, but you might just turn that around and say, in a certain sense, all people are religious. You know, interesting, Ira, you go back to the word cosmos in Greek, from which we get the word cosmology, and by the way, also cosmetics. It's a very interesting word because it means order, arrangement, and beauty. Somehow, the Greeks recognized that the way the world was ordered made sense, that it brought together both its, whatever its material formation was, but also its meaning. And that's, in the work of the council, one of the crucial things we're trying to do is preserve. Now, the word preserve is a very interesting word, and the word conservative is a very interesting word. I'm from California, so I can't exactly be a conservative completely, but I'm conservative where I think there's something to conserve or preserve. And currently, in the recent work of the council, we issued a report called Reproduction and Responsibility. And if you go and you look at that, you recognize that what we're trying to do is preserve that integrated unity of the world in its order, arrangement, and beauty. We're trying to preserve those human goods which give life both its mechanism and its meaning simultaneously.
Well, why should that be a government committee's job? Why should that not be the church or the synagogue's job? Why should that your job just to be to find out how it works?
What you mean, to be a purely scientific body?
Yes,
we're appointed as an ethical
body.
Well,
I mean, but why should
ethics
you be
by its nature is how we should live.
Why should that be the government's job, to be an ethical body?
Because we're a civilization that governs itself along certain principles and valuations of the good. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's poured right into the foundation documents of our civilization. You know, go ahead.
We're all dying to jump in here. I mean, somebody, someone in the United States government should be an ethical body, and why not? Mm-hmm. Why not have it? So, of course, one should have an ethics reflective body.
I'm not arguing that. I just want to.
But my objection is, even the very description that Dr. Hurlbut just put forward was a Christian idea about how the world might look, or one Christian idea about how the world might look, not the idea of religious people. For instance, for Jews, the world isn't a cosmos in perfect unity and harmony that must be conserved. The world's unfinished. And
I didn't say it was, Laurie.
But we have a lot of work to do, not to conserve the world, but to change it, and to work towards perfecting it, and to work towards making it just and humane and healthier. And that sensibility that the world is profoundly unfinished, we're not in the garden, our task is not preservation, our task is tikkun olam, the restoring and repair of a world that is in fact unfinished. That's a very different set of sensibilities, and it leads to a very different set of bioethical reflections.
That's not incompatible with anything I said, I'll tell you that, because I endorse that notion.
All right, we've run out of time. I'd like to thank all my guests this hour, William Hurlbut, member of the President's Council on Bioethics, consulting professor in the program in human biology at Stanford, Laurie Zoloth, director of bioethics for the Center for Genetic Medicine, professor of medical ethics and humanities and of religion at Northwestern, Susan Jacoby, director of the Center for Inquiry, Metro New York, author of the book Free Thinkers, A History of American Secularism, out by Owl Books. Thank you all for taking time to be with us.
Thank you, Ira.
Thank you.
Thank you.